Colonel Glenn, as you reflect now on your historic Friendship 7 flight, what are the things that seem most significant about the flight, particularly as it applies to man beginning to move into space?
Well, I suppose the most important thing in general terms is the fact that we can now design spaceships for future explorations and for future scientific endeavors with the idea that man is capable of operating in space. Man adds an adaptability and a reliability to these missions that we didn't have before. Up to this time, we've been just trying to determine what man could or couldn't do. We know now that man can operate in space, and so for the long-term design of future ships, this becomes important.
May we go to you personally for a moment? Now that the flight is over and the whole world knows about your achievement and also about the Russian cosmonauts' achievement, do you feel that the term hero applies to all of you? How does that affect you as so much of the world gives you its acclaim for this endeavor?
Well, I don't know exactly what the definition of hero is, but I think there are many heroes in this program, at least on our side of the water. The team effort that went into something like this, I believe the final count was that we had somewhere over 19,000 people involved on launch day, directly in getting this off and tracking it around the world, bringing it back in, recovery, and the whole operation. This big, tremendous team effort, of course, makes many heroes and puts me, I guess, a little bit like an iceberg, maybe, you might say. I'm a little bit showing up on top, and there are awful big volume of people underneath that are getting very little attention, of sight.
I think I know one reason for this, and you may agree, and you might comment on this. This effort, moving man into space, is so complicated that it isn't an individual thing at all. It isn't like a Columbus and a few sailors in a boat on the water. It isn't like a Lindbergh flying the Atlantic, is it?
No, that's very true. It's a big team effort. It has to be because it's a very extremely complex operation.
Would you comment briefly on some of the things involved, like the manufacture of the booster and the capsule, you know, General Dynamics?
Well, there is those things that you mentioned certainly are part of it, the manufacture of the booster, the capsule, establishment of a recovery force that has to operate around the world, a tracking network with all of its people at 16 different stations around the world, all of the international agreements that have to be worked out on that. I understand that we have some 40 different countries that have reciprocal agreements with us as far as exchange of this type technical information goes. All of our recovery forces, our launch crews, our control center people, all of these things are necessary to make up a space mission.
As we plan more space flights into the future, do you think there will be closer and closer ties among the nations with whom we're already cooperating, particularly those with the tracking stations? And would you mention them, discuss them briefly?
Well, I've been involved in this area only from an operational standpoint, of course, of seeing how the tracking stations operate. I have not been involved in the political area of trying to set up these stations. So exactly how much cooperation is going to be needed in the future is not my field exactly, but I would certainly think that international cooperation on these things was certainly going to be at least as important or more important in the future than it has been on our flights to date.
Then the COSPAR organization is a big factor in this, isn't it?
Well, COSPAR is more of a meeting ground where ideas and information are exchanged. It's not primarily an organization that sets up operational patterns. It's a forum for exchange of information. In that regard, of course, it is an important help in exchange of information between countries.
Many of our listeners, of course, are in the countries that have already participated with the United States in tracking your orbit mission. Those people have a big interest in our launches too, don't they?
Well, I'm sure they do, because part of our tracking network being in their countries gives them a great interest in all of our efforts. Most of these stations, too, are manned, of course, and to a large extent, even a number of the technical people are from the countries where the stations are located. So a lot of their own people in each of these countries are taking part in our missions and are part of the whole Mercury team.
During your flight, what was your reaction toward the teamwork of the people below and nations around the world?
Well, we mentioned the fact that this was a big team effort, that there is a tremendous effort involved in getting all the information back. This is really the purpose of all the tracking network stations around the world, is a gathering and accumulation of all the data from the flight that really makes the flight worthwhile. Just to go up and do something like this as a stunt, of course, is pretty much non-productive. But we're not looking at these flights as stunts just to show that these can be done. We're looking at it to gather data we need to make progress for future missions. And in that respect, all of these different stations are indispensable in this gathering of all of the data. They form a very important link in getting all of the information back and in usable form. Some of these stations that cooperated with us and have been so helpful and performed these vital functions all around, well, their function also goes a little bit beyond that. In some of the stations, of course, we have what we call command functions, where these stations can actually send commands to the capsule to do certain things in case the astronaut was unable to do them himself. So in that respect, they become more than data gathering facilities or communications links. They become command centers of their own if this is required. The station in Bermuda acts almost as an alternate Cape Canaveral for control of the mission in case anything goes wrong at the Cape, for instance. The radars at Canary Islands give us our refined radar data we need to establish the trajectory parameters and the orbital information that we need. The station in the center of Africa, Kano, is another link in that net. And Zanzibar, of course, is our last link on the coast of Africa before we start on across the Indian Ocean. Once you get to Mushe, Australia, once again at that point you're close on your apogee or highest point of the flight from the Cape, and we need trajectory data from the radars at Mushe and farther on into Australia at Woomera. Canton Island is our main link coming up across the Pacific that is not a United States possession, and beyond Hawaii then we come into Guaymas, Mexico, which is our first land link at the end of the first orbit to give us all the information as we come back over the mainland for the first time. All of these stations operating from foreign territory are very vital links in the whole chain of not only the command functions to the capsule, but also the gathering and organizing and relay of information back to the Cape that make the whole thing worthwhile.
All contributing to the greater teamwork effort.
That's right.
You know, we mentioned just a few minutes ago the comparison, or the lack of comparison somewhat, between the individual efforts of man throughout the ages and then this particular teamwork endeavor that you feel so strongly there. Do you think there's much comparison between your flight and the Charles Lindbergh flight 35 years ago? Incidentally, this is the 35th anniversary of the Lindbergh flight.
Yes. Well, I think there's a lot of similarity. We talk about the team concept, and we feel the team concept very, very strongly, because we certainly cannot get one of these things off and around the Earth by ourselves. On the other hand, there's only one man in the capsule when it's up there in orbit, too. So you might say that the teamwork gives us a lot of togetherness, but there's also a great amount of aloneness in this thing, too, once you get it off the pad. This is the area, of course, where there's sort of a fine line, I guess, between where it becomes where the team effort stops and where it becomes pretty much of an individual effort. There's really a place for both in the program, I guess. The contribution you make after you're up there is certainly one that you make on your own. But there still is a big team on the ground backing you up, and the launch effort in particular and the recovery efforts, of course, are solely team mechanisms or team operations.
You were really never far away from them throughout the whole flight.
Well, I don't know. Emotionally and communications-wise, no. Physically, yes.
A question or two about your flight itself in Friendship 7, Colonel Glenn. After so many rehearsals, was the real thing somewhat anticlimactic?
No, not at all. The rehearsals, of course, just make you more ready to go, but nothing can replace the mission itself, I don't think.
You've emphasized your busyness and the fact that you did have lots to do. Did this carry on throughout the complete orbital mission? Did you have time to think very much about what it really meant about your being up there?
Well, we're aware, of course, of the implications of this from a geographical exploration standpoint, as well as some of the political aspects that have been people try to read into the program. But I'm afraid when you're involved in a mission yourself, you're mainly concerned with the technical problems involved just on the mission. And you don't really sit up there and contemplate too much about the political aspects of the whole program. I didn't anyway. I appreciated the fact of where I was and what I was doing and the implications it might have, but actually on the mission itself, you have such a little bit of time for any extraneous thoughts that I'm afraid you concentrate more on the mission at hand than anything else.
May we go back personally into your career as you became an astronaut and on your decision to start flying. Did you fly much as a youngster?
I started flying. I don't remember my exact age. I guess I was about 18, I guess, and I took a civilian pilot training course in college. Liked it very much, and then later when World War II broke out, I thought that I would probably go on into flying, and did, and have been flying ever since.
When did you join the Navy and the Marine Corps? Was it at the outset of World War II?
I started training shortly after Pearl Harbor in early 1942, and I've been flying ever since.
You went straight into flying when you entered service?
Yes, that's right.
How did this lead you on into becoming a test pilot?
Well, I guess a lot of flying experience and combat background, things like this. I was interested in test flying. All these things led me into test work. When I came back from the Korean War, I applied for test pilot training and was accepted for it. And it was a natural progression of my interest in flying and the interest in the future of flying.
Would you tell our listeners something of the types of planes that you tested?
Well, mainly I've been a fighter pilot throughout my career, and these were the type planes that I specialized on, although I have flown most types. But the ones that I did most of the test work on were fighter-type aircraft, jet fighter aircraft.
Then you believe that your experience as a pilot, and particularly as a test pilot, were the major things that were taken into consideration in your selection for the astronaut training program?
Well, there were a number of criteria set up for our selection as astronauts. Those have been pretty well covered, I believe. Test flying and a lot of jet flight experience was just one of the criteria.
What was your thinking as you decided on this flying career after World War II, as you and Mrs. Glenn began to plan your family and the plan for the future?
Well, I don't have any real profound thoughts on such a subject as that. It was a natural progression of what I had been doing during the war. I liked to fly, enjoyed it, and decided that I would like to make that my life's work. It was as simple as that.
I understand one of your hobbies, John, is skin diving. Is there any affinity there to the weightlessness of space? Is there any similarity?
Oh, some of our training when we first started this was along that line, that it might be similar. I personally have never felt it was too much like it. It may be somewhat like the weightless condition, but I don't feel that it's too similar. Skin diving is just a lot of fun. I like it. That's the main reason I do it.
How do you feel about the fame that's been thrust upon you as a result of the flight?
Well, this is something that's come rather suddenly, of course. We've tried to accept it in stride and remain the same type of people we were before. It's a little difficult sometimes, of course, when you can hardly even go downtown and go shopping as we used to do without being interrupted so many times when you move around. We don't resent this at all. people are very interested in it. It's a thing of the future. It's caught the imagination of everyone, and it's quite a big, wonderful thing. I think the emotional attachment that a lot of people have developed toward this, where they're so excited about it, caught us all possibly a little bit by surprise. People, I think, sort of see themselves as almost riding with you in the capsule. They're so interested in it. And when people feel that way about it, you can't be unhappy that they are giving you a lot of attention when you're out in public sometime.
Colonel Glenn, historically there's a problem of communication between the scientist and the layman. In the teamwork effort of the Mercury Project, do you think this has been improved? How did they, the technicians involved with the Project Mercury program at Cape Canaveral seem to be able to communicate with reporters and the public who are brought into contact with you? You think we're achieving something in bringing this communications closer?
Well, I think so. This is such a new field that it's been an education for everyone, and I might add, including those of us that are right in the middle of it, as well as to the layman. Having our missions conducted completely in the open, as we do at Cape Canaveral, where, with the information available and sent around the world immediately, just within seconds or minutes after the actual occurrence of a certain event, lets everyone really, internationally, all over the world, share these missions with us and is an education for them as well as for us. Carrying that idea a step further, we have also been very free with the information, the results of the flight that we have gotten. These have been published, have been available to technical and scientific groups in every country around the world. We've held back nothing on what we learned from the flight. And I think we have made great strides, tremendous progress, and we're laying a broad scientific base that will enable us to have even more ambitious undertakings in the future.
You think that the scientist and the non-technical person involved in the project, then, that these people do talk the same language better now?
Oh, certainly. This it's a new field. We're all being educated in it, but certainly we all get together and have a sharing of common views and common objectives, of course, whether we're a scientist, layman, or engineer, whatever we are.
Recently, you met with the Soviet cosmonaut, Kalman Titov. Would you care to tell us how you felt about meeting someone from the other side of the world who is in this same endeavor?
Well, we're always glad to meet with anyone who is interested in this field, of course. We had a very interesting meeting. It was very cordial and interesting from my standpoint, and I'm sure from what he said it was from his standpoint, too. We shared some information. We hope that we can go ahead in the future and have a more clear exchange of information on all these fields. We naturally are building a broad scientific base for future exploration out of this country. We think this would be of benefit to them if we can share this information, and we are very happy to share this information. On the other hand, there may be some fields, perhaps, that they are more advanced than we are. We don't know. They could share this information with us. A mutual exchange of information is always very conducive to cutting down suspicion and distrust. So I think any information we can exchange certainly projects itself along that line.
Do you foresee possible space flights with other nations?
Well, I think probably so in the future. We would certainly hope so.
Have you given any thought to life in space?
Yes,
that's
certainly. That's a good one. I'm afraid my reading and my investigations in that field have not been very extensive, however. It's an interesting thought to think of whether we may run into life on other planets or other celestial bodies someplace. We're just working pretty much day-to-day right now on the project without worrying about that. I'm sure that there... I don't discount nor do I have any theory to prove that there is life anywhere else but on Earth. I'm sure if we run into this some of these days in our explorations, it's going to prove extremely interesting, however.
Maybe we'll have a... what do you think of this philosophy of a silicon-based type of life in some of the other...
You couldn't prove it or disprove it by me, but it'll be interesting if we run into it.
Why must man go into space?
Well, that's another broad one. It's an extension of our exploration here on Earth. I think that any exploration that's been conducted here on Earth has been, if there's been one thing proven in the past, it is that that exploration and scientific advancement, our knowledge of our surroundings, any exploration of this or any new information on it has proven extremely beneficial and probably of more benefit than any of us can foresee at the outset of any such exploration. In this country, for instance, back in the early colonial days, Lewis and Clark, for instance, were two famous explorers here, and when they made their famous explorations to the West Coast or to the way out in the wilderness, people thought they were wasting their time, and they were criticized because the government even sponsored them on this. But their explorations paved the way for more ambitious undertakings that were far, far more advanced and from which we reaped tremendous benefits later on. Almost any exploration that has ever been undertaken on a major scale for new information has had a way of paying off in the future far, far more handsomely than anything that was ever foreseen at the outset.
You are touching on something I wanted to ask you further about, and that is your feeling on the philosophical aspect of man's spirit of adventure. I think you must feel that very strongly to be in the work in which you're involved. Man as an individual, as the human aspect and that thing within us that makes us continue to want to explore new things.
Well, this is true in all fields. If man has a capability for doing something, he wants to do it. And we now have the capability of going into space and of investigating this firsthand. So we want to do it. I'm no philosopher. I have opinions just as I'm expressing here, that if we have the capability of doing something, we should do it.
You feel that science and religion are reconciled, that there is a rapport between the two that is explainable.
Well, I've never been aware that there was any place where they were not reconciled.
To you, then, there is no problem as you fly into space about a greater being?
Oh, none whatsoever. I think our any little explorations we have here, I make no claim of knowing make no claims of knowing the nature of God any more than anyone else does, but God is certainly greater than any little explorations that we're making in space.
Colonel Glenn, as we broadcast this interview to the people around the world listening to our worldwide English broadcasts, is there anything else that you think would be of great interest to them?
Well, I don't think anything in particular. We've covered most of the details in earlier broadcasts or earlier dissemination of information around the world. We plan to continue this through subsequent flights. We're looking forward right now, of course, to the flight of Scott Carpenter, which will be coming up very shortly. And in that regard, Scott will use the information I got to make more detailed experiments in space, to get more complete observations of some of the things that I saw and did, just as I used the information before. It's all a big stepping stone process. He uses the information I received or I was able to obtain. I used the things that Al Shepard and Gus Grissom were able to do as stepping stones for my flight. It's a big progression and a big exploration program. We have a long way to go, and we all need to cooperate as much as we can in order to get the job done as soon as possible.
Thank you very much for being with us, Colonel Glenn.
You're welcome. Thank you.